So, but first, let's get right to Tom Barbalay. Tom, are you with us?
Hi, Tom. Mark
Am
Stevens.
Am I coming through?
Yeah, Tom, can you hear us? You're on the air. Mark
thank
Stevens.
Thank you for having me on.
Hey, thank you for being here. We're pleased to have you. Hey, I understand that you are, in fact, an artificial intelligence expert. Maybe you can give us a little bit of your background. I know that you're the author of a computer program or architecture. I don't know how you'd even describe it exactly. Named The Noble Ape, and we'll probably get to that a little bit later. But maybe you could give us a little bit of your background as far as how you got into the field of artificial intelligence.
How did I get into the field? Well, I didn't really get into the field. I think I'm one of many who practice a particular form of, organically inspired artificial intelligence called artificial life. And many of us really didn't come to it through any formal education. I was studying physics and philosophy, and I was about 19 at the time. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I'd developed a lot of bits of software up until then that had various kind of emerging forms of intelligence or life or a wide variety of different characteristics. And I was sick for a period of time with mono and looking to kind of distill a lot of the software that I'd been developing. And the thing that struck me was that it was very difficult to actually test philosophical principles in simulation. So what I did was create a very rich environment, a biological island environment initially with a wide variety of plants and animals and simulated interactions and all different kinds of simulated biology.
So these are totally simulated inside a computer software program.
Certainly. Okay. Yeah. So the ideas were that the scalability associated with simulation, i.e. the richness of detail, just hadn't been achieved up until that point. And I used some relatively novel principles from physics in order to get a high-resolution simulation environment created, which was the origins of Noble Ape. And also, there were intelligent agents, simulated apes, that inhabited this very idyllic simulated environment. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the various theories in artificial intelligence, neural networks, and various other kind of behavioral theories weren't up to snuff in terms of actually dealing with a rich simulated environment.
Right.
So I looked back at some of the software I had developed simulating petri dish populations and looked at the way the information flowed in those kind of bacterial simulations.
Mm-hmm.
And then used that to model two competing ideas, one that I call fear and one that I call desire, and created a novel cognitive simulation method and put it all together in this thing called Noble Ape.
You know, that makes perfect sense when you talk about fear and desire, because mm-hmm. it seems like that's how kind of we as humans structure our own lives, whether we like it or not. Now, when you say high-resolution environment, that doesn't necessarily mean visually, like graphics high-resolution. That has more to do with the reality of it mathematically?
Both, actually. What I found curious was that certainly with the early development of Noble Ape, there was a good feedback into the graphical environment. And I'm currently talking to you from Las Vegas, Nevada. The thing that got me over to the U.S., to Silicon Valley, was in fact the graphics component of the Noble Ape simulation, because basically once you have a rich organic environment that can be modeled down to not the size of a grain of sand, but certainly kind of clumps of sand up to potentially planets, you need a means of actually conveying that to a general user. Now, obviously, there are scientists that can get pages and pages and pages of data out of those kind of simulation environments. But if it's not visually pleasing and richly visually pleasing, then your average user probably won't be able to get the same kind of interaction. And my view was always to create something that perhaps undergraduates, perhaps even high school students could be receptive to. So, yes, it was, in fact, both parts. It was both a simulated environment, but also a means of visualizing that environment. And certainly the latter part was something that a number of folk over in the U.S. got very excited about, which moved me here in 1999.
Right. You know, we throw around the term artificial intelligence, and I suppose that any machine that has the capacity, and I'm just going to kind of throw this out, and you take it where you think it needs to go, but any machine conceivably that can make a decision, whether it's a thermostat or, you know, is it too hot? Okay, I'll turn the heater down. If it's too cold, I'll switch it back on. Could that be considered a rudimentary form of intelligence? And kind of where I'm going with this is, what is artificial intelligence? And maybe we need to define what intelligence is, just intelligence, artificial or not.
I think that's critical. And certainly when I was looking for a definition of intelligence, I went to paleobiologists, because basically they were dealing with the very first workings of intelligence out of organic systems.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a fellow called Roy Plotnick, and he described the circumstances associated with simple cellular organisms learning about feeding grounds and kind of working their way between feeding grounds, and then slowly they built this ability, that really quite sub-intelligent, to move between these feeding grounds, and then that was kind of refined over time. So my definition of intelligence comes purely through survival, which in and of itself is relatively controversial.
Yeah.
But I certainly think that if we start with the concept of survival, then we can ascribe intelligence as survival to a wide variety of organic and inorganic systems.
So
that's where it gets particularly interesting.
So, the ability to survive is kind of the catalyst or genesis to intelligence in an emergent system. Is that kind of where you're?
I think in any system.
In any system. Okay. Yeah, let's talk about the noble ape a little bit more. I understand that was at one time kind of either purchased or absorbed into Apple Computer. Is that right?
No, noble ape has always existed independently. It is something that I do after hours, in fact. It's not connected with anything that I do professionally. But it's been used by both Apple and Intel and a wide variety of other companies to do some very interesting things. Apple started using noble ape formally in about 2003, and the thing that interested them was that they had a wide variety of processor technologies that weren't particularly efficient at doing complicated mathematics.
Mm-hmm.
And noble ape basically tickles a wide variety of parts of the math within processors, but also in terms of memory use and moving between various areas of memory, it does some interesting things there as well. So they originally started using processor metric, but as we described initially with regards to the simulation, both graphical and mathematical, they then realized that the real-time visualization, which has always been a central part of Noble Ape, was also very useful for a wide variety of other application authors, third parties, and also even within Apple.
Mm-hmm.
So they used this very tight mathematical core that I developed in Noble Ape plus the visualization as a means for firstly, creating metrics for processing, which is the rather cute 8 brain cycles per second, which is still used at both Apple and Intel,
mm-hmm.
and also as a means of looking for bottlenecks that would slow down graphics or would stop real-time graphics. So if you think currently about technologies like QuickTime and streaming video, and I'm assuming people are listening over the internet, streaming audio, all these kind of technologies have a real-time interaction, but a very tight mathematical core.
Mm-hmm.
So they use Noble Ape as a, I guess, an independent example, basically, in order to tune these kind of high math-intensive processor interactions together with a real-time component. And Intel then picked it up for things that were relatively similar. So it's used both in terms of tuning, also as a third-party developer tool to show these 8 brain cycles per second and how they can be optimized, and also a wide variety of other uses. And Noble Ape is open source, which means anyone can download the source code, they can do whatever they want with it. There are folks, a wide variety of companies that have used Noble Ape for a number of things, and I mean certainly the example associated with Google and CERN is relatively interesting as well. But I think that probably answers your question associated with Apple specifically.
Okay. Now, as far as the community of these simulated apes, would how would that actually happen? Would you give this community of simulated apes a problem and then expect the... I posed a question to you before the break, whether basically the mechanics of introducing a... Is it a problem-solution utility or tool, the Noble Ape program?
So your example associated with the Noble Ape solving problems is an interesting one. I mean, let's just take a step back. I think Noble Ape has been used in the social sciences more to test theories and approaches. So, for example, testing the response of agents to specific environments, also testing various agent models, like do we understand how humans react to natural disasters, for example? What's the existing theory? Can we put the existing theory into the Noble Ape simulation, see how the Noble Apes react, and start testing the existing theory?
Okay, kind of like Google does to us.
Certainly. Very much so.
And we might talk about Google a little bit, because But there is a little bit of news as far as Google having a computer that can anticipate human behavior, both on a micro scale and a macro scale. I don't know. I don't know if you have any inside information on that or not. But mostly, I'm more interested in the Noble Ape. Now, you mentioned how the apes would react in a natural disaster or in a certain environment or event, and then maybe extend that out into how people would react?
Well, the issue associated with the social sciences is typically creating testable situations and then putting the theories to work. And let's use Google as an example, because I gave a public talk at Stanford in July. And one of the fellows who came up to me afterwards, in fact, we had quite a long conversation as I walked through the car park, was a former Apple fellow who's now at Google. And there are a number of folks that have, I guess, taken the religion of Noble Ape from Apple to Google. Mm-hmm. I don't know specifically what Google is using Noble Ape for, but I do know that there are a number of people at Google who have a background knowledge of Noble Ape. And if any of them are listening in, I really do like receiving source code submissions back. But mm-hmm. what this fellow put to me was that, so imagine that you have a simulated environment. Rather than the apes being entities in an environment where they're consuming fish and, creating family histories and, getting afraid of other apes and mm-hmm. Fierce cats that are attacking them, imagine that they
are... Oh, you have cats.
...simulated internet users. And that rather than their interactions being things like eating and moving around and having children and teaching the children and these kind of things, they are, in fact, simulated internet users that are performing searches, looking through sites, doing a wide variety of behaviors that are relatively well understood. So my understanding is, and this may or may not be the case, but Google has used the Noble Ape simulation to create a simulated internet user, multiply that by hundreds of thousands of times, and then see how close they can get the responses from the simulated internet users to the real stream of internet users, and then basically grow theory on that.
And use that as a benchmark. Get the simulation as close to reality and then use that as the benchmark?
Well, no, not necessarily a benchmark, but just as a means of testing theories.
Oh, I see.
Because obviously
sure.
A company like Google, flies on its intellectual property, and the intellectual property that would be generated through that would give a better understanding of what an internet user actually is with regards to tuning advertising, a wide variety of other things that Google does. So really it's removing the Noble Ape from the simulation to, the human in front of the screen. So, that is one possible use of the Noble Ape simulation.
Right. I would kind of like to take this, extend this a little bit further. We're talking about a relatively, and sorry for the pun, a primitive group in the Noble Ape software, even though certainly it can perform some pretty, astounding feats, when utilized, the extent that it can be. Where do you see? Well, let's talk about a sentient or actually conscious or self-aware computer. Are we close to that?
Well, I think the problem is that we are very much caught up in our own view of our own intelligence. And certainly what you find, and what I found through Noble Ape, is that agents can exhibit very intelligent and very survival-centric behaviours without actually needing to have a lot of underlying intelligence. And I think a lot of the discussion associated with super sentient computing and all this kind of stuff is very much caught up in the same paradoxes of intelligence that have been, I guess, writing philosophy treaties for the past two and a half thousand years.
Sure. What is consciousness? What are we?
Exactly. So if you remove yourself from that aspect of the question, if that's possible, I think what we see with modern day technology is vastly super sentient, and the real issue is how we then create a philosophy or a means of understanding how we actually exist in this society as kind of sub sentient creatures as opposed to super sentient creatures. And that in and of itself is philosophically very sticky.
Sure. Yeah. Well, ultimately you get to the big question: do we have souls? And if we build a computer that's clever enough that we wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Let's look at that. How would you test for that?
I think what is particularly fascinating is that the current financial system basically enacts murder and various other things independent of human control. So irrespective of whether you want to talk about individual humans having souls, the current financial crisis is as much created by the super technology and the interaction and the lack of human insight and control as it is anything else. And when you're talking about vastly complex systems, it's probably better to start at that level rather than looking at the potential of what is quite, in itself, quite an abstract construction versus, for example, foreclosures, people are unable to get work, and a large part of this actually being created by the system that manages all of this, yet no one has any control or insight into.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So how far away do you think we are? I mean, there is Moore's Law, and I know there are some hardware restrictions and you know, certainly some software restrictions on just how fast these computers would have to be to achieve a thinking machine or a machine that, and let's just say it, kind of the HAL 9000 of 2001, where, if unless you were in the same room with it, you would never know that you weren't speaking to another human being. Is it kind of comparing apples and oranges? Is a computer intelligence or consciousness going to be different than and maybe we're anthropomorphizing. We're applying our human values and ways of looking at things to something that is expressly not human. I know there's a question in there somewhere.
I think that's exactly the point. I mean, this is the horse-car paradox. I mean, we are fundamentally horses, and computers are fundamentally, well, not even cars, but they're as car-like in their intelligence as we are horse-like in our intelligence. So it's, the humans are like horses on a hill looking down on the freeway saying, sure, they're fast, but they'll never quite be horses. And I think this is the real paradox associated with any question of machine intelligence versus what we perceive to be our own intelligence.
Right. So, I don't know, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years?
I'm post-singular. I believe that basically the technology is super sentient and fundamentally controls us. So my view is that we are, in fact, completely blinded by our own views about our own intelligence. And what is actually happening to us currently is that the technology, the infrastructure and the vastly complex systems that we have created are ultimately working independently. And I don't think it's a question of processor power. I don't think it's a question of Moore's Law. I think it's a question of things like the financial system, which are beyond our immediate intelligibility or control.
Yes, and specifically to the economy.
Yes. So I think there are a wide variety of examples of vastly complex systems that are clearly transcend our own intelligence. And the economy is a good one because it's currently doing, well, its own bidding, independently of any kind of human insight, control, or understanding. So it's a good one to use currently.
The most technologies, I'm sad to say, at least in, well, actually, arguably all throughout history, have eventually been either a product of or applied to the taking of human life through warfare. And obviously we have autonomous drones and things of that nature. Where do you suppose that will go? As you know, is it going to get worse and worse, in other words?
Well, according to Wired magazine, and my sense is that this is probably the case, the technology that governs drones is relatively trivial to actually create.
Yeah, they're autonomous, but they really don't have the capability of making a decision. Or is that close?
Well, the function of a drone is basically to enact casualties, and the way in which those casualties are enacted is independent of ideas in artificial intelligence. It relates basically to primitive explosives and a wide variety of other things. But my sense is that the stuff that goes on with regards to drones and kind of tight military control could probably be replicated. And, I mean, Wired magazine, I think, put out a story a few months ago in the slide that all these kind of technologies could be used, in the worst possible ways against us as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, and that's the sense that I get, too, that these what do they call them, UAVs, their job isn't to make moral decisions, it's just target acquisition to a preset rule, and then it goes and does its thing and comes back.
Yes.
Okay.
It doesn't need to come back. I mean, there are a wide variety of technologies which don't require it to return at all, and they're certainly the cheapest and the easiest to implement.
Right. Hey, we may have some callers. Let me give the phone numbers just in case our audience would like to ask you a question, if that's okay.
Certainly.
The phone numbers are 801-254-5855 or 801-670-5855 or 801-470-5855. And if you want to get in touch with us directly, sector5radio.com, and be sure to click on the Facebook link. Tom, Isaac Asimov talks about the kill switch or something similar to that, and the three rules. And I think they were self-preservation, obey humans and do no harm. Do you think that we even need to worry about that, those rules, to build those into our smart machines yet?
I think the smart machines have already been built without those rules. I
mean,
to point out what I'm advocating here, I think we need to have an active philosophy, an active understanding of the contemporary world. I'm not a futurist. I'm not talking about, what is happening in 10, 15, 20 years. I think, unfortunately, we've been let down by a wide variety of scholars and people down to politicians associated with how we actually understand these systems. So my interest is, as a simulator, to actually get an understanding of where we are currently and hopefully utilize this understanding to actually generate what's commonly called simulation science. It's kind of a broad set of interdisciplinary frameworks in order to understand where we are currently.
Mm-hmm.
I think the three Asimovian
rules. Oh, by the way, Tom, this is Captain Proton. He's a co-host.
Yes, and the three Asimovian rules are to obey humans, to by action or inaction to cause no harm to a human being. The second law is to obey humans. The third is for self-preservation. And so the question that I would pose to you is that seems to be extremely hard to do if your machine has emotions, yet everybody seems to want to have emotions. There's more and more research in causing a software to have behaviors that are replicate emotions. Is there a need for that, do you think, or do you think that's just dangerous to have a machine that really feels, cries, upset, angry?
Well, I think, certainly there are examples of robots that need to have that in terms of their interaction with humans. But returning to the example of the financial system, I'm not sure that has emotions in the context of any kind of description.
Tell that to somebody who lost their 401k.
Well, no, that's exactly my point. My point is that the financial system in no way models the emotional impact that it has on the the humans that it interacts with. It just carries
on its victims. Now, you mentioned philosophy. You know, I'm fascinated on how someone would actually get into this field. It sounds like it's such a new field, and I don't know how long would the field of AI be around? Probably not more than 50 years.
Well, I mean, to be clear, I'm part of a subset of which is really not even overlaps with AI, called artificial life. So it's been around for about 30 years. AI, well, I mean, in conceptual form, it predates Plato. I think basically when people start talking about how long has something been about, there will always be scholars that go back and find even more information prior to whenever someone wants to put a line in the sand. And with regard to artificial life specifically, if you go back to the 15th century, you can find philosophers talking about concepts in artificial life. If you talk about artificial intelligence, it goes well back prior to then. Obviously, they weren't talking about computers then. They were talking about thought experiments, views of reality, perspectives on a variety of different things. But in terms of a hard discipline, obviously, it comes around at the point where the term is coined. But I think academically and in terms of just a general population, these ideas are pretty fundamental.
Yeah. So basically, it would boil down to someone, as far as artificial life and or artificial intelligence, You would want to have what under your belt? A good, solid basis in computer science and philosophy and...
I think people come to it from a variety of different areas. There's a group of artists that pick it up. And I think what you find is that the areas of knowledge that you don't have, you have to pick up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So people come to it from a wide variety... I mean, even musicians and artists come to these ideas and they will learn to either program or learn the mathematical background or... If you are friendly with people that can program and these kind of things, I think that can also be assistive. So really, people come to it from a wide variety of different areas. I mean, I'm not a formally trained computer scientist, biologist, or anything like that. My background was in physics and philosophy, although I'd written antiviral software and done a wide variety of other kind of computer science-y things like compilers, but I never did that formally academically. I've always done that in parallel. So I think, really, the thing that has always interested me is... certainly when I started NobleApe, I started getting emails from children, 8 to 12 years old, 15-year-olds that were actually quite conscious and aware associated with the various programming problems that they needed to work through. And my own background in terms of when I started writing AR simulations and antiviral software was relatively young. I mean, I started NobleApe when I was 19, but I started this kind of programming when I was about 14 or 15.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it just takes a passion and interest and an ability to, to go out. And if you can't find the information, you try to work back from first principles and create it through, many late nights, this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, NobleApe, how you mentioned it's open source. Now, that's still available to the public then?
Certainly.
Okay. And how would, they just do a Google search for NobleApe, or is there a specific
website?
Yeah,
NobleApe.com. And from there, they can download. I do a relatively canned version of the simulation just to get people interested and involved and get a sense of what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are a wide variety of other interfaces. I mean, obviously, some scientists prefer to run it and get data, which then they then import. So obviously, there's a kind of simulation core, and then there's a variety of skins that are put on the outside. But it's available for Macintosh, Windows, and Linux. I've maintained those three platforms. There's an iPad version, which you need the software for. It doesn't go through the iPad Store, and a wide variety of other versions that people have written. There's a web server version, which people use for long-term simulation, a variety of other interactions. So, yeah, I mean, if you go to NobleLake.com, download the software, have a play with it. Obviously, what you see in the initial downloaded software isn't the full kind of suite of stuff that's been done with it, but it gives a kind of potted idea of what the NobleLake simulation is about.
Right. And the long term, are you at liberty to discuss some of those long term projects that might be interesting?
Well, I mean, I think what I've always found is that the users that get involved, the folks that actually download the software, be they independent hobbyists or companies like Apple and Intel or academics, I mean, it's a source of kind of continuous wonder for me in terms of the ways in which people actually use this thing that I wrote. A large portion of my time is actually spent maintaining it, and when people do get in contact with me and say, I'm interested in looking at this, or particularly there's a fellow in the UK who did some development and is now looking at political structures and the way in which a politician grows from early childhood through to, I guess, being elected president or prime minister. And so there are a wide variety of really quite curious uses of the simulation that keep me interested. So the user base is always taking it in different directions.
I'm sure the world of psychiatry would be fascinated with the results of that particular project.
Certainly. I think what the fellow was interested was looking at whether you could actually find points of explicit corruption and whether you could use these kind of corruption metrics to actually track a variety of politicians and kind of see into. I mean, I like to use the term vastly complex system rather than artificial intelligence because I think they're two very heavily loaded words, but certainly the vastly complex systems that we see, you know, taking jobs, foreclosing on folk and doing a wide variety of other things, you know, seem to be working at their own pace quite comfortably. I think in terms of computation, in terms of understanding, my hope is that a group of academics will actually get together and kind of join hands and start working on describing the contemporary reality of these things. And certainly that's what I'm trying to kind of continue with in my general instigation and development associated with NobleApe, and also kind of bringing together a community of intellectuals that are willing to talk about such things.
You know, I can't help but think that there are some inherent dangers in a computer that thinks, particularly that one that has control of the infrastructure. And here's my kind of nightmare scenario. If we were to feed a computer a problem or get accustomed to feeding a computer a problem, a social problem, economic problem, or even a military problem, and continue the trend of asking computers to help solve our complex system problems, might not that computer eventually come to the conclusion that we're the problem?
Well, when I say that I'm post-singular, I'm not joking. I mean, I think this has already happened. And the thing that interests me, because when you kind of state that you're post-singular, people say to you, well, when did the technical singularity actually occur? And I think of it more as a smear, but I think certainly in terms of computer technology, computerization, what you're describing, this actually existed sometime prior to the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. In fact, really, that early?
I think the technology was really in place prior to then, and what we are seeing now is very much post this environment, where discussions associated with kind of warm, fuzzy morality, computing, and ethics, and all these kind of things are just so, I mean, they just seem like dated concepts to me. I think we are dealing with something that is vastly beyond that, and we need to have a kind of contemporary intellectual discourse to understand what's going on currently.
Yeah.
Sir, this Michael, Captain Proton. In 15 years ago, I was looking at programs that were helping Interpol, the models of what they were telling us were helping Interpol solve crimes, like group behaviors and actions and things like that. Are you familiar with those kinds of programs?
Certainly.
The question, and now we have GPS on almost every car right now, and we have an ability to basically have cars shut off. Like if you're driving certain vehicles, it's just an integral part of your car, they can shut it off. Are you worried? Do you ever see a future where basically we're the we're now the children of the machine in the way that the machine sees us as just not as quite as intelligent as we are.
Are you familiar with the Toyota brake problem?
Say it again, please.
Are you familiar with what happened to Toyota in terms of their braking problem?
Yes.
I mean, I think we already, that's probably the most pertinent example of that.
For those who aren't, maybe you can give us a thumbnail on that.
Well, I don't know. From a high-level sketch point, it was that the computer controls related to the braking, well, actually, it's not really clear because Toyota gave a number of stories associated with it. But let's just put it this way. The humans that were actually applying the brakes weren't smart enough to run the brakes according to the brake systems. And, fatalities ensued.
Right.
Maybe it was getting a little payback. I've seen all kinds of reports, like there was a Romanian lab in which the machine just went wild because it killed some people. And there they were trying to do an emotion experiment to things where we have something a little more innocuous, like the Google car that drives itself, that can anticipate things, slows down, speeds up. It's not really an android. It's more of a robot that anticipates. It's more like an expert system. What do you think are we going to see, like, people just buying planes that just fly themselves here pretty soon, where you just have your own personal, almost Jetsons type of car because you don't need to have all the skills to fly the thing or drive the thing? You think that's within 10 years possible, that we only have our own little plane, if not jetpack or whatever?
So I'm not a roboticist expert, but I have a few friends that follow these things, and they say that contemporary insurance is actually working against that. So we could have that technology already, but there are a wide variety of influences which have got nothing to do with the technology that have stopped that up until now. So my sense is, this is not a field of expertise that I have normally, but when I talk to people that know some things about this, they seem to think that there are things that are independently stopping this as opposed to where the technology is going. So my feeling is that all things considered, and probably a wide variety of hobbyists are already working on this, those technologies would be there already if it weren't for non-technological related forces that were working against that.
Right, so the technology isn't the barrier for that
exactly.
to come about. It's more of a... Okay.
So basically, your solution to it is a Shakespearean solution: kill all the bean counters and the lawyers, and we get our really cool technology.
I've always been surprised about how slow things develop. I mean, I'm you know, a very early reader of science fiction with the view that the future that would be created would be absolutely amazing, and I'm really very disappointed with my iPhone in that line.
Yeah, where are our flying cars, Tom?
Well, I think our flying cars have been stopped by a wide variety of factors that pure technologists alone couldn't factor in. What's interesting is that the emerging simulations are now finally starting to take note to these kind of parts, and certainly let's call them the friendly simulations, the ones that are used for insight rather than complete automation, seem to indicate that what you need to start doing is modeling Washington lobby groups and a wide variety of other things to actually get insights into why these things aren't here yet.
Yeah. Do you think there's a risk? I mean, we've talked about, you know, the nightmare scenario of Terminator and Skynet and, you know, computers and robots taking over. But do you think there's an even worse risk than that, where as computers and complex systems begin to think, and I use that term kind of loosely, that people will stop thinking?
This is the Wikipedia effect. This is what you're describing. That basically you don't need to learn anything because you just put the few words into Wikipedia and then you find it.
Right. The tragedy of Twitter. how risky is that? I mean, and what can we do? Or maybe the solution might be to continue that trend into a seamless interface between humans and AI or computers, into kind of a transhumanist, I think the term is.
I've talked to a few transhumanists. I don't think they're that grounded necessarily. But let's return to the idea that people ultimately in the current society need to have jobs in order to basically earn money, in order to pay for internet services, in order to run Wikipedia et al. And I think what is interesting, and this also is probably a function of being post-singular, is that the people that have the technological skill set associated with that have also been progressively devalued financially, primarily through things like outsourcing, but also basically now through fundamental simplification in a lot of these technologies, in large part because they can't actually, well, the companies can't show profits and actually fund engineering at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I think the real problem is that we can all become entities that are fundamentally unemployable but also unable to create and maintain these technologies. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a very interesting paradox that we see ourselves in currently.
Right.
Well, working with the video game industry, I don't see that as a problem, as because it seems like the best technology comes from porn and entertainment and games, because they all develop those things first. No, this is really serious.
Hey, Tom, we're coming to the bottom of the hour, the end of the segment. Could you give us your websites and how to find that information again and maybe your blog as well?
Certainly, Mike. I'm more than happy to be returning guests as well, because I do these
we'd love to have you.
Unfortunately, these discussions never actually work to a time frame. The easiest way to reach me is just noblapee.com. That is in noble, as in noble person, ape, as in ape. And you can find me from there. You can find a wide variety of things and literally hundreds, if not thousands, of hours worth of recorded audio discussing these very problems.
Yes, and a lot of it's pretty technical. I listened to some of it, and I have a computer programming background too. And a lot of it was over my head, especially
these things. But I think what happens is that if you find stuff that is at your level, you can kind of work from there. Unfortunately, with just the diversity of listeners, we have to cover everything, and some of it is probably even too technical for people of the graduate programs or even PhD level. So unfortunately, we just have to cover everything. So you might find something that piques your interest through the. But yeah, if you just pick a random one, you may get one that is completely in its own technical rat hole.
Perfect, Tom. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Mark.